Hare Krishna. So I apologize for being late. We were caught in the traffic, unfortunately. So I'm honored to be here amongst all of you. And I'll speak today and tomorrow on the topic of spiritual vision of material beauty. Material beauty, which is a very attractive force in this world, how can we see it spiritually? Now, this is a section of Pingala expressing her realizations. So she is a prostitute and she is just another day for her at work. It's not another day, it's another night at work. But this turns out to be a night where she does not get any business. And the Bhagavatam is actually so inclusive in depicting how spiritual awakening can happen under any circumstance. We may not think of a prostitute as a candidate for spiritual awakening. What to speak of a prostitute who is at her job? But the nature of the soul is that the soul always has a tendency. The capacity for spiritual awakening is always there. And the Bhagavatam describes the unlikeliest of settings. Vritrasur is fighting on the war field against Indra. And he's fighting just as a demon, is destroying the demigods, just overpowered Indra. And as he's speaking, goading Indra, come on, fight. I'm going to kill you. And then at that moment, suddenly, you know, while he's speaking, suddenly his mood changes. He says, I'm going to kill you and I'm going to destroy. I'm going to take revenge to at one who is a killer of his own brother, who is a killer of his own, who is a killer of my brother, who is a killer of a brahmana, who is a killer of his guru. He's furious. Then suddenly his mood changes. He says, if however I'm not able to kill you, then I will give up this body, which is anyway destined to the ashes. In this, I will give up this body in the service of the Lord. And suddenly he starts longing for the Lord. So Vritrasur, we know that his Chitraketu, he was already a great devotee, but because of a curse, his spiritual awareness had temporarily been covered. So at that particular moment, that spiritual awakening happened. Gajendra was living just a materialistic life. You know, he had his she elephants, he had his children with him, and he was enjoying, having a good time. And he was caught. And then the spiritual awakening happened for him. So, spiritual awakening can happen to anyone at any time. And in this case, her frustration leads to realization for her. So, her verses of realization are very instructive. In fact, this section is often in traditional in bhakti culture, her song is actually sung. Just like we have verses which are, the Gopi Gita is sung, even these verses are also sung. And they're called as the Pingala Gita. And this is sung and it is considered one of the most illuminating sections philosophically. The devotional aspect is not so much there in it. We will see later it is there. But it is primarily a realization, a depiction of a journey from frustration to renunciation to devotion. Now, frustration is something which everybody experiences in life. But most people who become frustrated, they give up the enjoyment for some time, but afterwards they again take up the enjoyment. So to go from frustration to renunciation. Frustration means I can't get it. Renunciation means I don't want it. The two are very different things. So in frustration, the desire is there, but the capacity to get it is not there. Renunciation means the desire itself is not there. So the frustration and renunciation are not the same. And it's like somebody who is fasting because it's a holy day and they want to fast, and somebody is fasting because their stomach is upset. They want to eat, but they can't eat. So from frustration to renunciation. that frustration everybody experiences, but the journey from frustration to renunciation is not so common. And from renunciation to devotion is even more, even less common. Because in that case, the renunciation often makes people hard-hearted, makes people want to aspire for impersonal oneness. So, her verses describe the journey from frustration through renunciation to devotion. And in the previous verse, Santam Samipe Ramanam Mriti Pradam, says that Lord, He's always close to me, He's always there in my heart. Vittapradam Nityam Imam Vihaya, I gave up that Lord who could have given me so many things. And Akamadam Dukkha Bhayadishoka Mohapradam Tucham Aham Bhaje Agya. It's Agya. I was so foolish that I gave up the Lord. So normally, you know, when I say when a prostitute engages in her job, you know, it's to get money. So Ritta, she wants money, Vitta. But then he says, she was not just looking for Vitta. Now she uses the word Ramana throughout. She was expecting love. She was expecting that somebody I will find who will love me. So she was expecting money. She was expecting pleasure. She was expecting love. And she realized that actually all this, the Lord is ready to give me. But Vihaya, I gave Him up. And how unfortunate I am. And I was chasing after, looking for men who cannot provide me this. They themselves are dissatisfied. They themselves are not satisfied. So how can they provide me this? And in this verse, she is, the one thing is, oh, I turned away from the Lord. I left Him for something so little. So she's now thinking, but what did I do after leaving the Lord? Aho mayatma paritapito vritha. I just tormented my soul. Sankitya vritya tibhigarya vartaya. Srila Bhakti Sanskrit Thakur explains in his Bhagavatam commentary over here that Sankitya vritya refers to actually the expertise of a prostitute. The politically word today, collect word for prostitute today is escort. You know, is the art which people which they have to awaken, to arouse desires in them. So their gestures, their expressions, their body movements, everything, such a way that they can trigger the desires within people, the lower desires within people. So, we all live in a community. And, you know, we all interact with different people in different ways. Now, human beings are social creatures. And to regulate the interaction of social beings, we have culture. Now, what exactly does culture mean? A culture, often people, every country, every city, even every group of people, they have their own culture. People often associate the word with culture with the language, with the dress, with the food, with the mannerisms. Yes, these are what comprise culture. But if we look at it in a more expansive sense, now we use the word culture is also used in biology. Say, for example, is bacteria culture or yeast culture. That means what? It's a biochemical medium where bacteria can grow or yeast can grow. So similarly, human culture is that environment where people's humanity can grow. That culture, that social environment where people's human side can grow. That is human culture. Wherever people are, they are going to dress, they are going to eat, they are going to have some language for communication, they are going to have some modes of, some manners, that's fine. But human culture will be that which brings out the human side within people. Now, we all have a higher side and lower side. We have a Hiranyakashipu within us, we have a Prahlad within us. And the spiritual, the human culture is that which actually brings out our higher self. So we are born human beings. We are born in human bodies, but it's not automatically that we'll act like human beings. Animals are simply driven by instincts. So, you know, if a cat sees a rat, the cat cannot think, today is Ekadashi. I should be fasting today. The cat will just pounce and eat that. So the animals are simply governed by instincts. We human beings also have instincts. But along with the instincts that push us to act in particular ways, we have intelligence. And with our intelligence, we can choose which instincts to act on and which instincts to resist. And to the extent we can do that, discipline, when we say discipline essentially means to resist our instincts based on our intelligence. What I want presently versus what I want ultimately. Hey, somebody is dieting. What I want ultimately is I want a healthy, fit body. What I want presently is I want a taste of this good food. So discipline means I am able to subordinate what I want presently to what I want ultimately. And how do I know what I want ultimately? That is with intelligence. So the human culture is that environment which nourishes people's intelligence, which helps out to bring out their higher side, to decrease their instinctive actions. But when there is an excessively materialistic culture, then that materialistic culture focuses not on bringing out people's higher side, it focuses on bringing out their lower side. So say, as human beings, we are born with human bodies. We have instincts, we have intelligence. Now, if the intelligence is best used, then the humane side within us increases and it rises, ultimately the spiritual level. So, if we don't have a spiritual culture, if we have a materialistic culture, then the human side, in that the intelligence is not nourished, the instincts are triggered, and then people degenerate from the human level to the bestial level, to the animal level. So in that sense, human existence is at a junction, at a cross section. And if we consider three modes of material nature, sattvaguna, rajoguna, tamoguna, goodness, passion and ignorance, the essential characteristic is that there is, in goodness, there is contemplation before action. I think, should I do this? Should I not do this? Then I act. There's contemplation before action. And then the action is purposeful. It's quite often fruitful. In passion, there is action before contemplation. I speak. Hey, why did I do that? Why did I say that? Why did I do that? And in ignorance, there is neither proper action nor proper contemplation. Just driven here and there. Sometimes we're just paralyzed, not doing anything. Sometimes we just act in a frantic way. Frantic, frenzied way, panicky way. So basically, if you consider from the perspective of instinct versus intelligence, intelligence is strongest when there is the mode of goodness. I mean, there's contemplation first and there's action later. The instinct may push me to act in a particular way, but I say no, I'll not act this way. So the intelligence is strongest there. In ignorance, it's just instinct. Sometimes people in ignorance, they do action, they don't complete even one action, go to the next action, next third action. They just can't do anything properly. So, aprakasho apravrittischa moham eva cha pandava. Krishna says that prakasha, illumination, is the characteristic of the mode of goodness. It's 14.11. It's pravritti, is action. I have to do this, I have to do that, I have to do that. That is the characteristic of the mode of passion. And moha, illusion, is the characteristic of the mode of ignorance. So, now, in human culture, the truly human culture is that which increases the goodness within people. Now, dharma itself has various meanings. The Bhagavatam is primarily a book of transcendence. And the Bhagavatam defines dharma as paradharma. Paradharma is transcendental dharma, which helps us to develop love for Krishna. The Bhagavatam is considered to be the natural commentary on the Vedanta Sutra. And the Vedanta Sutra begins with the question, Athato Brahma Jigyasa. Just as there is Vedanta Sutra, Vedanta is one branch of knowledge within the six, it's six systems of philosophy evolved in India. One of them was Vedanta. So, another was what was written by Jaimini, Mimamsa. And the Mimamsa Sutra begins with the question, Athato Dharma Jigyasa. Now let us inquire, what is Dharma? And in the context, in that context, many different definitions of Dharma are discussed. One definition of Dharma is that which increases the sattva within people and decreases the rajas and tamas. So those activities that increase goodness and decrease passion and ignorance, that is Dharma. This is not transcendental, but in material. That which increase, that is also, then Dharma at a material level also. So, and that is also important in for the conduct of society properly. So here Pingala is lamenting, what did I devote my life to? Sankhetya vrityati vikarya vartaya. That this is an abominable profession. Now today's politically correct culture is that, you know, we should not have any value judgments. Nobody, if something feels good to you, it's good to you. Something feels bad to you, that's bad to you. But not make any value judgments in general about it. It may be, yes, we don't want to be judgmental in terms of looking down at others, demeaning others. That is not good. And that really alienates people. So I was in Texas and I saw one car with a sticker, bumper sticker on it. It says, "Oh God, please save me from your preachers." Now, God actually saves us through his preachers. But if the preachers are self-righteous, holier than thou, condescending, people say, "I don't want to have anything to do with these people." So, "Oh God, please save me from your preachers." So this typifies today's mentality that, you know, nobody likes judgmental people. And the very word preaching is associated with being judgmental. You're putting yourself on a high platform and you're looking down at others. So yes, we should not be judgmental. But at the same time, you know, judgments are simply a fact of life. If even the person who is a complete moral relativist says, you know, morality is completely subjective, completely relative. And if we ask them, do you think that somewhere in the world someone is doing something that is wrong? See, of course. Yeah, there are terrorists killing innocent people. There are child abusers. There are rapists. They're doing wrong things. So now, if you ask the jihadis who are killing innocent people, they don't think that they're doing wrong. They think they're doing the right thing. So when you are saying that they're doing something wrong, what are you doing? You are actually imposing your moral standard on them. You are judging them by your moral standard. So judgments are simply unavoidable. And we all instinctively understand that there are certain things which are right and certain things which are wrong. I was in America and I was giving a corporate seminar. I was talking about moral relativism. You know, after that, one person came. He said that he was an Amazon employee. And he said in Amazon they have apparels where they depict dresses, and mostly it's female dresses, and they often depict females in seductive poses over there. But they said, "We have a policy that for it's only for the apparel of women, not for the apparel of girls, because we do not want to promote any abuse against girls, against small children." So here their goal is to sell products, but even then they also draw a limit. Now, this is something which we will not do. So nobody can actually be a complete moral relativist. You know, all of us have an understanding that there are right things, there are wrong things. And some of us may have differences about what is right and what is wrong. But we all have that. So in the word vigariya vartaya, it is an abominable profession. So somebody may say, no, prostitutes, you know, they are just... you know, for whatever reason, maybe they had no other alternative, that's why they got into that profession. So why are we calling that abominable? Yes, it's not so much a judgment of the prostitute herself. It is, what is the effect? Now, as it says, prostitutes, often they bring out the lower side within people. So lower side within people. That means, as I said, there is instinct and there is intelligence. So when people want to succumb, indulge in their instincts without any consideration of dharma, that is when they go to prostitutes. And then prostitutes are trained. There are different kinds of prostitutes also. Some are trained in such a way that they know how to seduce people. They know how to turn on people. So this is where instead of bringing out people's higher side, people's lower side is being brought out. And when this happens, then collectively society gets degraded. So in today's world, there is this idea that, you know, there should be freedom of expression. Whatever you feel like doing, you should be able to do it. Yes, we may say there is freedom of expression, but this same thing of, you know, bringing out the lower side within people, well, that is done in today's world as probably the biggest industry today is the pornography industry. So what is it doing? You know, in America, there is baseball, there is basketball, there is soccer, football. So these three are like the biggest games. And huge money is involved in these games. But the franchisees of all these three games combined together is less than the revenue from the pornography industry. It's huge. So now what is it doing? Essentially, it is bringing out the lower side within people. The basest impulses within people are brought out. And when this happens, then collectively society becomes degraded. So human interactions should be in such a way that we help bring out the higher side within people, not the lower side. We should all interact with each other in a way that, you know, we all have a lower side, we all have a higher side. So we help each other to bring out our higher side. Now, to dress attractively, to look good, that's a natural human instinct. But when people do that in a way that they want to seduce others, they want to bring out the lower desires in others, then that becomes a big problem. Now, this is not a female versus male issue. It's a psychological issue. Now, males may also want to flatter women so that they can do all kinds of things with them. So whichever way it is basically in human interactions. You know, we have to see what is the result of our interaction with others. Is my relationship with someone bringing out their higher side or is it bringing out their lower side? So we should act as agents so that we can help people to bring out their higher side. And when it is in the Bhagavatam, it is said the Madhyam Adhikaris. The Madhyam Adhikari are the intermediate level of people. So they discern between different kinds of people. Ishvare Tadadhineshu Balisheshu Dushatsucha Prema Maitri Krupopeksha Yaha Karoti Samadhyama. So those who are Madhyam Adhikari, those are middle level devotees, they worship the Lord. And they make friends with the devotees. They are kind and compassionate to the innocent. And they stay away from the envious. So they differentiate between different people. Now why are they not kind and compassionate to the envious? They want to be. But the envious are such that the more they hear about Krishna, the more they hear about Krishna's glories, the more they see Krishna's devotees, they start offending more and more. Then that offense, they are cursing God, they're cursing God's Krishna's devotees. That is bringing out their lower side. And a devotee doesn't want to bring out anyone's lower side. The devotee keeps a distance from them. Keeps a distance. We serve such people through our prayers offered from a distance. So in our interactions with others, we are meant to bring out our higher side, not others' higher side, not others' lower side. So when the interactions are especially designed to trigger people's lower side, and this is done not just at an individual level, it is done at a social, cultural level. Today it is done using the best of technology. Then collectively, society starts getting degraded. And then when people's lower side is triggered, then it is not so easy once the instincts are triggered to check the instincts. Once the instincts start getting activated, then our lower instincts are like a sleeping tiger. Suppose the tiger is sleeping and we are walking along. We just move along. This the tiger sleeping will go on. But you know, if I think, you know, is this tiger really asleep? We go and pinch the tiger. And when I go and pinch the tiger, I mean, is this tiger asleep or is this tiger dead? Well, if the tiger is not dead, then soon I will be dead. So, let sleeping tiger sleep. So like that, we all have a lower side within us. We don't have to trigger that. And in society, becomes a large part of social society's resources are dedicated to triggering people's lower side, whether it be lust or whether it be greed or whatever else. Then it becomes the society just goes wildly out of control, because once people's lower side is triggered, then that takes over, and then that makes them do things which they themselves would not normally do in their normal course of actions. So, the whether it is lust or whether it is greed, whatever, you know, often when people say who are not so financially well-to-do, they are living in their own society. They not that they are happy, but they are okay. But when people who are not well-to-do are constantly exposed to all the wealthy and luxurious things of life through advertisements, through televisions, then the desires within them get fueled so much and they feel, I just have to get these things, and by hook or by crook. So Krishna talks about this in the Bhagavad Gita, that from 16.11 to 16.15, he talks about how when somebody is very strongly attached, that when they're determined that I want to get material pleasures, then what happens is Asha Pashitair Baddha Kama Krodha Parayana Ihante Kama Bhogartham Anyayen Artha Sanchayan. So when they're bound by desires, I want this, I want that, I want that, and then that leads to Anyayen Artha Sanchayan. Anyaya means injustice, atrocity. So basically, what Krishna is telling over here, sensuality leads to immorality. It leads to not just immorality, it leads even to people doing atrocities. The next verse, he says how such people may even turn murderous. Asaumaya hata shatrur hanishye chaparanapi. I have eliminated this rival. I'll kill this person also. Idamadyamaya labdham imam prapse manoratham. I've got this much money, I will get more money. And I'll get more money. So basically, when people's desires are triggered, then even if they have some moral sense, that moral sense just gets cast aside. And then it's like the beast within them gets awakened. And when the beast within them gets awakened, then they just end up doing terrible things. Sometimes when that beast becomes silenced, they get, why did I do that? But over a period of time, when that beast gets awakened again and again and again, then they just, their conscience also becomes deadened. And they start doing the same thing again and again and again. So, human culture is meant to bring out the best within, not the beast within. The best within. You know, we are all parts of Krishna. And as parts of Krishna, we all can be godly. We all are meant to bring out our godliness. And when we interact with each other, we interact in a way that we help each other to rise upwards in our spiritual life. And this is not even a spiritual principle. Even for the material well-being of society, if people's desires are triggered in an inordinate way, kama is, Krishna uses the word kama both in a positive and a negative sense. Krishna uses the word kama to refer to to lust in a negative sense when he says kama is the enemy. He says in 3:36-43, he talks about how there's an inner force which destroys, which makes us do terrible things. He talks about kama in a negative sense. But then the 7th chapter, also in the 10th verse, he also talks about how dharma aviruddho bhuteshu kamosmi bharatarshava. I am kama. Kama can be specifically translated as sex desire. Kama can be generically translated as desire, as ambition. So, I am desire which is not contrary to dharma. So, it is not that we, while we are living in this world, it's not that we are going to be expected to be free from all desires. There are going to be desires in us. And that's why in every society, there is some cultured way in which desires can be fulfilled. So, Srila Prabhupada would say that there's marriage. And within marriage, the desires can be fulfilled. Similarly, there is ambition. We all have ambitions in life. I want to achieve this, I want to get this, I want to earn this, I want to do this. Now, the test is, the karma, the ambition should not be at the cost of dharma. When it is not that, while living in the world, we have to give up all ambitions. Ambitions, we all have naturally. But when the ambitions make us give up dharma, then that is where it becomes a problem. So, naturally, the very nature of existence is that we want to grow. Just as we physically grow, we want to socially grow, we want to economically grow, we want to culturally grow. But there is growth that is balanced and there is growth that is disproportionate. All the cells in the body, they are growing. And that's how a child grows from the childhood to adulthood. But this growth is proportionate and balanced growth. When there is a cancer cell in the body, that cancer cell, when it grows, its growth is disproportionate and disastrous. The cancer cell grows and its growth causes the other cells in the body to get destroyed, causes even the whole body eventually to get destroyed. So, the material growth, when it is proportionate with our all-round growth, when karma is growing, it's managed within the precincts of dharma, then that's proportionate growth. Dharma, artha, kama, moksha, these are purusharthas. They are what human beings are meant to aspire for. This is what people live for. But it's proportionate. But when only one thing is growing, when one cell is growing at the cost of the growth of other cells, then that is cancerous growth. So cancerous growth destroys the body. So karma is a natural aspect of the human condition. But in the balanced trajectory of human life, there is dharma in the beginning, then there is artha, there is karma, and there is also the ultimate pursuit towards moksha. But in today's society, dharma has been removed and moksha has been removed. All that is there is artha and karma. People want money and people want material enjoyment. And people want, often, if they can get the material, they can get the material enjoyment without having to work to earn the money, that's all the better for them. So this is disproportionate. So when people pursue artha or karma without dharma and without any ultimate aspiration for moksha, then that is like cancerous growth. And just as cancer destroys the body, you know, a cancerous culture, in the sense that a culture which induces the growth of cancerous desires within people, disproportionate growth of certain desires, whether it be anger, whether it be lust, or whether it be greed, in such a society, destroys itself. And for the society to move upwards, for the society to grow, the specifics of the culture may be different in different parts of the world. Whether it's in India, or whether it is in UK, or whether it is in the West, in America, or wherever it is. The specifics of the culture will vary. But broadly, all over the world, people have understood this principle. You know, that there has to be some kind of a regulation in the society. There has to be some kind of regulation by which the people's lower side is not intentionally triggered. Lower side is not intentionally triggered. A Western culture is now considered degraded by many. But actually, the West was not like this. Even 100 years ago, 150 years ago, even 100 years ago, the culture was quite conservative. One devotee sent me some accounts of when the Britishers first came to India. They considered, so the British women who came to India, they considered that the Indian women, because they would just, India is a hot country, so they would just wear footwear, chappals and move about. They would not cover their legs with any socks. And they say, you know, how can you go out in public with your legs bare? And so the Britishers considered Indians uncultured, Indian women uncultured, because they were going around with bare legs. So now, it's not just bare legs, people go around with practically very little clothes. So even 100 years ago, whether it was the West or the East, there was the understanding of chaste dressing, chaste culture. But many things have happened. There was especially the free sex revolution that came up. And among many factors, there was this psychologist, Sigmund Freud, who had this idea that actually all mental problems that people have, they are because of their repressed sexual desires. He was brilliant in his own way, but he was a pervert. So in his childhood, he had sexual attraction for his mother. And he generalized from his experience and he said, actually, all boys are sexually attracted to their mothers. And all girls are sexually attracted to their fathers. But social taboos prevent us from acting on this. And because social taboos prevent us from acting on this, that's why there are so many mental problems. So subsequently his ideas have been completely discredited. Although he himself is respected, many of his ideas have been shown to be not at all scientific. But the point is, so when this whole idea came up, oh, mental problems are because of repression. So what is the solution? End all repression. Just do what you want to do. So there is philosophy, there is ideology, and there is culture. So once ideology comes into the realm of culture, then it becomes almost irreversible. Once certain ideas gain currency in people's minds, and that's how this whole idea of free sensuality, free interactions, all that gain popularity. And once it's gone into the popular culture, it's, although many of his ideas have been discredited, it's too late now. The society has become very licentious in its overall ways. And although thoughtful people all over are recognizing there's something wrong in the way people are living. There's a survey by the Harvard Medical School about the people who have what they call as free sex or free love. They found that these people, they all live to be sexually attracted to others. They try to attract as many partners as possible. And then they found that although these people, they have free relationship with others, although they call it free love, they all feel unloved. They feel lonely. Their bodies are coming in contact with many other bodies, but their hearts are not touched. It's not from a spiritual perspective, even from a material perspective. They know that they're using others and they are being used by others. So there is loneliness, there is guilt, there is the feeling of insecurity, profound insecurity. So where we think that our self-worth is determined by how much we can trigger desires within others, then that is a very unstable way to live. And that is something which, okay, what after the attractiveness goes away, what will one do after that? And even when the attractiveness is there, it's there for a short time. So that way of living, where one thinks that, you know, I have to trigger others' lower desires in order to live, in order to be happy, in order to be successful, that is a very fundamentally wrong premise on which to live. Most people may not consciously think like this, but subconsciously they're a part of a culture like that. So we are practicing bhakti, it's not just about chanting Hare Krishna or coming to a temple. It's about changing the fundamental purpose of life, the fundamental purpose of our interactions with others. As devotees, it's not necessary that everyone we interact with will become a devotee. It will be wonderful if they do. But in our interaction with others, we can at least try to help them bring out their higher side. And specifically with respect to beauty, what are the different visions of physical beauty and how that was understood and practiced in the culture of that described in the Bhakti texts, that I'll discuss in tomorrow's class. So I'll summarize. I spoke today about spiritual vision of material beauty. That was the theme. Within that, I focused first on how spiritual awakening can happen at any time, even to the most unlikeliest of candidates in the unlikeliest of settings. A prostitute who is just out on her job at night can get profound realizations which are sung by generations of spiritual seekers and devotees thereafter. That's what happened to Pingala, as it happened to Gajendra, or as it happened to Vritrasur. So her realizations describe the journey from frustration to renunciation to devotion. So I can't get it to I don't want it. And devotion means I want only Krishna. And in this particular case, she is thinking, oh, I left Krishna, who could give me wealth, who could give me pleasure, who could give me love. And I was seeking it in these other people who were themselves materialistic, who were themselves lusty. So he says that he laments about, I was engaged in such an abominable profession. What was the abominable profession? That I was bringing out the bestial desires within people. So we are born human beings, and that we have a conflicted existence. We have an instinct which impel us to act animalistically. We have intelligence which can guide us to act in a divine way, in a spiritual way. So from the human level, if the instincts are too much triggered, we will go down to the bestial level. If the intelligence is nourished, we will go to the divine or the spiritual level. And the three modes can also be analyzed in terms, in goodness, there is contemplation before action. In passion, there is action first, contemplation later. And in ignorance, there is simply delusion. Neither proper contemplation nor proper action. So, dharma is ultimately that which helps us to develop love for Krishna. In the material sense, dharma is that which helps bring out people's higher side. Has come, not their lower side. In today's world, there is a whole industry which triggers people's lower sides. And that's how millions of people, millions and literally billions of dollars are being made by triggering people's lower side. And when people's lower desires are triggered, it's like the beast within them comes out. And they themselves do terrible things. Krishna talks about from sensuality to immorality. And in atrocity, all kinds of terrible things happen. And it's not just at an individual level, which was always there throughout history. Some people were in that profession, kind of professions. But now it is at a collective social level where people's lower sides, lust, greed are being dragged out. And to say that a prostitute's profession is degraded, it's abominable, you may say it's a value judgment. So we discuss value judgments in the terms of being judgmental, looking down at others. That is not good. But judgments are inevitable. Everybody does judgments. And judgments we do based on what we think is good, what we think is bad. Some things are universal. Child abusers, murderers, they're reviled. So the point is that we all have an innate moral sense. The specifics may vary, but there's a universal moral sense. And in bhakti literature, we consider something good or bad based on whether it brings out our lower side, then it is bad. If it brings out our higher side, then it is good. And the karma itself is not bad. Karma, when it is triggered in such a way that it brings out our lower side, then it is bad. But when karma is regulated by dharma, then that is considered. Krishna says, I am that. And ambition is not bad, but when ambition is within the fetters of dharma, then it is good. Then it is like a proportionate growth, like the body's healthy growth. But when karma grows alone, at the cost of morality, at the cost of civility, at the cost of the of law, then it is like cancerous growth. It is disastrous. So there is the normal human progression was dharma, artha, kama, moksha. In today's society, there dharma and moksha left out. There's only artha and kama. And this kind of growth is cancerous. So we as devotees, when we interact with each other, our interactions we try to do in such a way that we help people to bring out their higher side. And the whole principle of bhakti is ultimately meant to bring out our higher side, to connect us with Krishna, to bring out not the beast within, but the best within. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Any time for questions or comments? Yes, Prabhu.
Thank you, Chaitanya Chaitanya. It's a wonderful to have you here.
Thank you. Honored to be here, Prabhu.
To see your podcast on the internet is very enlightening. I'm very pleased to have you here. I just have one question in regards to just speaking about the profession of prostitution. Could you help to explain how we know, I think you know, Dwarka, then when the Krishna came back, then the prostitutes, they approached to greet Krishna. So it seems evident that there was prostitutes in that society. And also in the Purple Prabhupada explains that prostitutes help keep the sanctity of society. So perhaps you can help us to understand how that's a fact, or how to explain that to someone that is prostitutes even in Dwarka, or how to understand.
Okay.
Thank you.
So, how do you understand that there are prostitutes even in Dwarka? And now there are three different things going on over there. See, first is that the bhakti literature is very specific or very unabashed in describing the inclusiveness of bhakti. That means anybody from any background can practice bhakti. That inclusiveness is there. Now there is that verse that even those who are lowborn, 9.33 in the Bhagavad, 9.32 in the Bhagavad Gita, that even those who are lowborn, Vaishya, Shudra, even they can practice bhakti. Kira, Tunandra, Pulinda, Pulakasha. All kinds of people from all backgrounds can practice bhakti. So the inclusiveness of bhakti is often unabashedly talked about in the bhakti literature. And if you see the mood of that particular section, then Krishna is coming, and when Krishna is coming to Dwarka after a long time, everyone is attracted to him. And Prabhupada says that, you know, one can even, in the purport, one can even be a prostitute, but if one is a devotee of the Lord, that is the important thing. So this means that the devotion is so inclusive that nobody is left out. That is the important thing that is stressed over there. We should, whenever scripture speaks something, we have to focus on where scripture is focusing. Otherwise, we may miss out on the main point that is being made. So the main point is that actually bhakti is so inclusive that even people who are of a profession that is normally considered to be degraded, even they can practice bhakti. And this is how all attractive Krishna is, this is how accommodating bhakti is. So that's the thrust. If you see, the point of that section is not to give a description of the social cross-section of any particular place. The Bhagavatam is a spiritual book. While conveying a spiritual thrust, there is this description also that is given. So the thrust is on how everyone was attracted to Krishna. Even prostitutes were attracted to Krishna. So, having said that first point, the second point to understand is that the word prostitute itself can have many different meanings. So, sometimes a woman who does not have a husband, she may be, she is not under the shelter of a husband. Sometimes, say women who were artists in the sense that they would dance in public during the celebrations, during festivals. You know, it would not be that cultured women would do that. There would be women who would do that. So in the Vedic culture, there were women who were called Devidasis. Devidasis, now some of the people, some of them, in the westernized media, they were depicted as prostitutes, and it says that temples were like places where all these Devidasis were there, and it was a place of prostitution. That's completely wrong. There were some women who would want to be completely devoted to God. And then they would come to the temple and they would dance for the pleasure of the Lord. And they would be devoted to the Lord. So now they were, by some people, because they were not under the protection of some man, they would be called as prostitutes. That's specifically about women who are devoted to God. But also others, there were artists. So the word prostitute can have many different meanings. It does not necessarily have to mean a woman who trades her body for money. So specifically, what that verse means, you know, that particular word means, there can be different meanings of that. Thirdly, even if we say that actually the prostitutes refer to women who were doing a business with their bodies, still the point remains that even in a place like Dwarka, we say Dwarka, isn't it a place where Krishna is there, that there are all pure devotees there? Yes, there are pure devotees, but when the spiritual manifests at the material level, then there is always a complex interaction that happens. The spiritual manifests at the material level, then in the ultimate sense, it's all a leela of the Lord. But in the intermediate sense, sometimes there are some things which are right, some things which are wrong. It's like Dwarkavasi, they're all pure devotees of Krishna. But at the same time, they all got into a drunken brawl and they fought with each other and they killed each other. That's how the whole thing ends over there. So there is a deeper explanation for that. Actually, Krishna wanted things to end in that way so that he could delude the demons. That is called as Asura Mohan Leela. So to delude the demons, Krishna sometimes acts in such a way which can lead people to conclude, to come to counter devotional conclusions. But the important thing is that in the ultimate sense, everything that happens in the Lord's immediate circle, that is transcendental. But in the immediate sense, there can be right or wrong. Yudhishthira's gambling Draupadi, that's wrong. But then through Yudhishthira's gambling Draupadi, the pastime of Krishna coming to the rescue of his devotees, that is enacted. So his decision from a moral point of view is wrong. He should not have stayed with his wife. But then from the ultimate perspective, it is Krishna orchestrated it all so that he could demonstrate a lesson. So like that, it may well be like, we say at one level, the devotees in Ayodhya, the people Ayodhyavasis, it's described initially in the Ramayana, that they were so heartbroken when Ram left. They were all wanted to come out with Ram. And Ram had to actually trick them. At night when they were sleeping, Ram woke up early in the morning and he left in the chariot. That's how otherwise they would all have come with him to the forest. They were so devoted to him that they were ready to give up. They were ready to take up with Ram the sentence of exile. But then yet, some of those, they ended up criticizing Sita. And they were criticizing Sita so much that Ram had to be separated from Sita. So, you know, when the Lord resides in this world, in a particular place, in a particular context, it's not necessary that everybody in that setting will be acting devotionally. So, so everybody will not be acting devotionally means that there is a principle of dharma, but the principles of dharma also vary for different people. For the kings especially, they are expected to be subordinate to sages. That is the principal activity of dharma for them. But along with that, they have royal opulence. They often had polygamy. They had many queens with them, and sometimes they might unite with their maid servants also. But the idea was, they would take responsibility, they would maintain them. And Dhritarashtra, he begot Vidura, when Gandhari was pregnant for a long time, he got Vidura through a maidservant. But then that maidservant was also maintained. So, the perimeter of dharma, dharma is a principle which regulates. But the circumference of what comprises dharma, that varies for different people. So that varies for different people means the principles of dharma at a material level for brahmanas are different from that for kshatriyas. And they are different from that for shudras. So actually Prabhupada says that at one level, there are people who are going to have who have excessive sensual desires. And for such people, within the, now they, rather than they contaminate society, the culture of women's society, there is a facility provided for them. So that means that the principle of dharma is not monolithic. It's like concentric circles. If you cannot fit at this level, you fit at this level. If you cannot fit at this level, fit at this level. But stay within some kind of regulation. So that way, if at all we are to argue that the word prostitute there refers to women who were engaged in prostitution, then also we understand that this could have been a part of the Lord's plan. Because when the Lord descends in this world, not all his associates all the time act in the mood of transcendental devotion. So the Lord will be demonstrating how the through such people, that the principles of that there may be people who are devoted to the Lord, but still that devotion doesn't necessarily lead to renunciation. There is devotion. That devotion does not necessarily immediately lead to detachment in that very lifetime. So even those people are accommodated. Many of the kings, they would be dharmic, but the dharma doesn't mean that they would be able to live life like monastics. They would be living in an opulent way. And as long as they had that intention for devotion, as long as they were doing the duty of protecting dharma, they had the different degrees of license within which they could work. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Hare Krishna. So, do we stop here, bro? Adin, okay. Yeah.
Is there time or no?
Sorry? Okay, from you. Yeah.
I'd like to thank Krishna for flying me here 10 hours 2 days ago so I could hear you speak today. I thank you very much. I read something online from the Bhaktivedanta Manor a couple of weeks ago. One devotee said that there's always gossip at the shallow end of the pool. And someone else said, well, there's gossip at the deep end of the pool also. And I write poetry, and I start to read this real quick to you. And this has a lot to do with me also. It's called The Tongue. I never get tired for moving along the long and winding road. Here, there, and everywhere, I gossip with them all, it is told. It is heard at the shallow end of the pool as well as the deep, traveling faster than the speed of sound through miles and miles I see. I can raise you up and I can cut you down. Your smiling face I can turn into a frown. How can you say yes when you mean no? Tell me the truth in this material world show. Just thinking about pleasure is enough to believe in this world. Even if it's false, our mind accepts it, ready to be unfurled. Our habits must change with their connection to enjoyments of the past. Pain has locked us in, O Krishna. You've told us it won't last. I'm as free as a bird as Krishna has broken the material spell. Always with me now, the Lord knows I know very well. The fresh air I'm breathing keeps me more devout. My mind absorbs Prabhupada's purports. No more do I twist and shout. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Yathra Shrimad Bhagavatam ki. Shri Prabhupada ki. Dai Gaur Premanande. Shri Chaitanya Charitamrita.